Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from Hugh Rimington, who's in here to talk about his new memoir, Minefield. Welcome, Hugh.
Hi, John.
Now, you've been on TV, you've been around the world, you've thrown yourself in the line of fire. You're a brave man, right? But memoir's another thing altogether. That's sort of quite exposing. You're handing yourself out to the audience to, you know, sort of get a bit more hue. And did you find it was made you feel vulnerable writing such things, or was it did your natural tendencies of journalism kick in and get you through the process?
Well, it's interesting actually, because the natural tendencies of journalism, by and large, if you're doing it properly, is to remove yourself out from the process as much as you can. Whereas it is a memoir, and I made the decision early on that I was going to have to be reasonably frank about failures, because my prime motivation really was to write it for my kids. Part of that is that kids, all of us as kids, have a view of our parents, and it may be a negative or a positive view overall. But one of the things is that parents are quite intimidating to their kids. And parents seem to know everything. And that can be a hard thing for a kid to get over, to realize that, in fact, their parents are thoroughly flawed. This is what adolescence is for, is to discover this about your parents. But because I've had what seems on the face of it to have been a fantastic adventurous life, it has been an adventurous life, and it's been moderately successful, and I've, you know, had some profile and these sorts of things, it was important to me to put in the rest of the stuff about how many mistakes I made, and also how lost I was as a kid. So I wrote in this stuff intending it to be something which I would, particularly the childhood stuff, to be something that I would write out, keep and give to the kids, then drop from the actual published book and just keep the book being the new stuff.
Yeah.
But I sent it off to the publishers and they loved it. And they've left all that stuff in there. So it is more exposing than I originally thought.
Yeah. Well, for a reader, we want to go on the exciting stuff. We want to know who we're going with.
Yeah.
So I can understand why the publisher would go, no, we have to have that in there, Hugh. You can't just let us jump in the back of the car with you and not really understand who you are. I mean, your background with your father's history and your mother's history, it's not you're not going into pages and pages of, you know, of detail, but you do give them a sketch of where Hugh came from, in a sense, and they're fascinating sort of stories of your father in Jersey during the war. These things all affect
how... Yes, because both of my parents were to a degree, and there's a generation who were just too young to fight in the Second World War, but whose lives, whose childhoods were completely marked by the Second World War. And I think that's an interesting element. Both of my parents were essentially grew to young adulthood trying to deal with the disruptions of war. My mother's father had been an officer in the Royal Navy. She basically didn't see him all the way through the war. He survived it. And my father was under Nazi occupation on the island of Jersey from 1940 through to the very end of the war. So he had a different experience as well that was going on. And at the end of the war, they, independently, they didn't know each other, they needed adventure. They needed to get away from this kind of war-blighted Europe. And they both turned up in Sri Lanka, Ceylon as it then was, and met each other there and married. So they had this kind of quite adventurous young adulthood. And
is that something you knew, like as growing up?
Yeah, well, I was born in Sri Lanka, so I knew that there was some of that, and bits of it came along. But then my father wrote a book for the family when he retired, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to write it for my kids. Mm-hmm. I think everybody should write that for something for their kids, because I suddenly understood so much about myself, because I understood who my father was. I tried to get Mum to write it, but she's never quite got there. So these are really important things, I think, to do. So there is that element of you know, I was a migrant. I was born in Sri Lanka. I was there till I was about five. We went to the UK. That wasn't working. We fetched up in the South Island of New Zealand, which is where I went to school. So I was very conscious of being a migrant in New Zealand. And then I more or less left New Zealand as soon as I could when I was 22 and came to Australia. And whereas a migrant again, I suppose. So that sense of constant movement. But also all the time when I was a kid, a wider sense of the world, a sense that there were different people in the world. I remember in Sri Lanka, for example, the beggars in the street, the crippled beggars in the street, was an early memory. I knew that there was this other world in it, and I spent my whole life really just exploring, expanding my knowledge of that world.
So this freedom, because I met people when I was living in England who were in Norfolk, had never been to London.
Yeah.
Australians, because of the migrant experience, the children of migrants seem to know that they can leave and wander the world and still come back and get on with life. Do you think that that's part of it, that there was a kind of an open door in your psyche that wasn't that sort of closeness that gave you the opportunity to live? Because it's a frightening thing. People go on Contiki tours because they don't want to do it themselves and be exposed to things. Leaving as a young man, was it a sense of adventure? Did you have any fear or worry?
Look, when I was a child, my favourite book was The Atlas. And I would sit as a child poring over The Atlas, looking at the places of the world. One of my pastimes, I remember, was sitting there drawing islands and places and creating them and sort of populating them with towns, where the harbour was going to be, where the hill was going to be. I was kind of doing Sim City long before any of that stuff was coming along. So that sense of the world and travel. And it's true, we've got this fantastic multicultural migrant Australia where people can come and go. But certainly what I've found is that you can come and you can go. And this book is shot through with this. But along the way becomes this tremendous love affair with Australia, which is a powerful force in my life. I love Australia and what it is. So, and it's been a source of, since I arrived here as a 22-year-old, even though I've travelled enormously around the world. I've lived in the UK for years. I've lived in Hong Kong for years. But Australia is this place I keep coming back to because I love it. There's nowhere else on earth, and it's a great base. And there's a place of safety as well when you're traveling into war zones and other kinds of places.
There are risks involved in going to war zones and the rest of it. There are also emotional risks in not being in the one place for a long period of time. What do you give up when you do your job?
Well, you know, there's a great line from Helen Garner who says, every time I write a novel, I lose a husband. and in a sense, every time I got a foreign posting, I lost a wife.
Right.
There's a reality to it.
Yeah.
You can't, it's incredibly selfish. And it's only now as I've started to wind back out of the hardcore travel that you realise just what a selfish bastard you become. And the thing about it is you're superficially attractive, in a broad sense. You become this adventurous person who's got stories to tell. You're always disappearing. So you have these kinds of engagements with people which are pleasant and positive and everything. But in the reality of it is you're a terrible partner.
Yeah.
Some people do it. I don't know how they do it. Some people have got marriages that last for decades with the foreign correspondent type of life, but I don't know how they do it. It's an awful life for the person sitting at home.
So some of the areas you've gone into have been extraordinarily dangerous. And whenever I see you standing in Iraq or in Afghanistan, I have the maternal instinct that rises up in me, and I think to myself,
it's very kind of you, John.
I don't like putting journalists just for the news in such dangerous places. What do your family think of you when you do that, when you put on a flak jacket and you head off into the war zone? I mean, I understand there's a role to play and there's a necessity of getting that information out to us so we can make judgments about what's going on and who to elect to either stop it or to increase it. But it's a big, you're taking on a lot.
Well, I mean, one of the things about that is that I think that there was a pivotal moment for me, and that was that I was in Iraq, in Baghdad, just in the lead up to the invasion in 2003. And I'd been sent in there to lead a small team that was going to stay in there, basically in Baghdad, try to survive until the first American tanks came in up the street and the place would be liberated or whatever, however you wanted to phrase it. And so we went over there with gear that was theoretically going to protect us against chemical weapons attacks, against biological weapons attacks, because this is what we thought Saddam was saying.
Just before you get to the going in, were there a group of people there and you put up your hand and said, yeah, I'll do that?
They knew I'd say yes. There was someone else who had been in there earlier and didn't want to stay on, but they always knew that if they gave me the call, I'd go. Yeah. It's nothing particularly courageous about it. I've got, I'd fear about these things like anything else, but once you're in there, you know, it is an adventure. It is a great adventure. It's a powerful, important world event. You have the task of trying to tell the story accurately, but also look after your team, make judgments about how you're going to bunker down for when the invasion phase comes and all the rest of it. And in that case, we were the last Australian TV crew in Baghdad. It was ours to go before invasion. We'd set up, I had gone to enormous efforts to set up safe houses in Baghdad so that if, you know, one place got bombed or it became unsafe, we could try and sneak across town to another place. It, you know, I'd slept for weeks in doing all of this sort of stuff. And then the bosses lost their nerve and they pulled us out. And that was, and the argument was is that it wasn't worth the risk. It wasn't worth risking our lives for a story and all this sort of stuff. And it really was a big issue for me. I left Channel 9 effectively because of that. And I had a great life at Channel 9. And I went to CNN. And part of that was because it was very much driven by the thought that CNN would risk its people. And my view was that what's special about journalists? There's nothing special about bloody journalists. When there's a war, there are people dying. There are civilians dying. There are kids dying. There are soldiers going to go in there and die. There are their families who are sitting at home wondering what's going to become of them, how it's all going to end up. What is special about journalists that they shouldn't be risking their lives to tell that story? So I don't believe in the notion of a suicide journalist, you know, that you go in there in the certainty that you're going to get killed. Forget that for a game of soldiers. But you should risk your life. And basically my view was is that if there's an employer who's not willing to risk their own people's lives to cover a war, they're not serious about what they're doing. So, you know, I have no particular fund of courage. I know myself well enough to know that. There's nothing unusual about me. There are people who've got, you know, utterly fearless, but they're very rare, actually. Most people have fear in these things, but you do it because something else is a higher motivator. So to go to CNN and then to go back and cover the war in Iraq for CNN, where you went out on patrol with the sergeants and the privates, where they were getting shot at, you were getting shot at. The very first patrol I went out, we went straight into an ambush. There were big bombs going off. We got out by the skin of our teeth. But that is actually the business of reporting that aspect of the war.
Yeah, well, in essence, by pulling you out, there's that very important role of being able to see behind. Because I mean, the Americans are controlling so much of access into those kind of battles. They are saying, no, we have journalists with us, we look after them, and they're right in the middle of everything, you know, this sort of talk. And then you've got these other kind of journalists that are going beyond those cushioned areas and getting out there to tell us the truth. And in this era, it seems even more and more important that we get out of the confines of corporate business and of insurance policies and all these things which hamper. They're often good reasons, you know, to do such thing, but they are actually enabling governments who are trying to do bad things to get away with it.
One of the things about the Americans, actually, is that they were quite indifferent as to whether you got killed or not, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, so we didn't have any, you know, military PR officers hopping from foot to foot telling us what we could shoot, what we couldn't shoot, or you can't say that. And soldiers, and I think this was one of the great protections, constitutional protections in the United States, the constitutional protection for free speech, meant that we were interviewing soldiers, and soldiers saying, we shouldn't be here. This is not working. It's a civil war. We're going to leave this place worse than we found it. Now, you couldn't get that in Australia. Australia is much more rigid and tight on its access to soldiers in the field. And soldiers would never express something like that, even though it was actually a truth.
Yeah.
It was the emperor has no clothes type of truth that was coming from the people on the ground who had a sense of to
help. Did you ever get any sense of if these people ever had any problem? I mean, if you're involved in a company and you speak the truth, your manager, your boss might come down and say, I understand it's the truth. I understand. I applaud you.
It's not a truth that we welcome.
Do you reckon there was downward pressure on people like that who were speaking?
Sure, I kept in contact with one of these guys, a Texan staff sergeant, a guy called Matt St. Pierre, who features in the book, and he got us out of a nasty, just his instincts, got us out of a very nasty ambush. He was 24 years old at the time. He'd spent 3 years in Iraq at that stage, and it was as a young adult, it was basically all he knew was, in fact, fighting the war in Iraq. And he said that he gave us an interview on camera, went right across the United States saying we're in the wrong war, we're doing it the wrong way. I was told by others that he'd probably miss a few promotion rounds when they came around. I've spoken to him since. He's never he is quite totally glad that he said it. Mm-hmm. He felt it needed to be said. And if there were consequences to him in terms of, he didn't get busted down, he didn't get cashiered or court-martialed or anything. It was the Australian experience. I was fortunate, partly because I suppose I had experience in the field with the Americans, that I went into Afghanistan with the diggers, and a lot of journalists had gone in there, had been frustrated beyond belief by the controls that were put on them and the inability to do it. And I really tried to challenge the Australian Defence Force. I had support, I know, from the top, from the then Chief of the Defence Force, Angus Houston, to go in there. And I had fantastic support from the senior officers covering that area of operations. And so I was able to go out on patrols and go to the most, the hottest zones in Afghanistan at that stage. There was up in the Baluchi Valley, there was a little base called COP Mashal, Combat Outpost Mashal, which at that stage was the most attacked place for Australian troops. And in fact, at the very moment we turned up there on an evening, the place was under full attack, full assault. And it gave us a very clear feeling of what was going on. Every time they went outside, they stepped outside that base, and they stepped outside that base every day to patrol. Four out of five patrols ran into what they call contact. So it was either a firefight, sniper attack, bomb. And so these guys were living right on the edge. And so to have the opportunity to go out and patrol with them, to see what they were doing, to go on raids where we captured some Taliban bomb makers, this is a great privilege, but all too rare. And one of the great laments among veterans of the Afghan War is that no one in Australia really knows what they did. Mm. And that sense of control of the message, instituted after Vietnam, where they felt they lost control of the message, it can go too far the other way as well.
Well, we're starting to get some books written by people who were involved in the war, so it was slow. But I think they're under quite a lot of control in those. They have to get vetted. Even fiction gets vetted by the army. The opportunity to actually tell the story in full, now that you've got a book to sit down and go, okay, good, I got to do a 30-second piece to camera on this particular episode. It was worth much more than that. I'm really glad I'm able to do it. Was that kind of the feeling here, that you could actually expand on some of these things which you experienced, which you only got to sell a fraction of it?
Yes, certainly. You're living this life. It's 24 hours a day of intense existence, and then you have a little story that comes out at the end of it. So there's these other details that come through it. And part of what I wanted to do is, well, I wanted to write it now, and I thought the time was right, was that the world of journalism has changed enormously. In the days when it was a very well-funded operation, I went off into Iraq in 2003 with $250,000 in US cash in a bundle handed to me, just in case I needed some money for some purpose. $250,000 in cash. In those days, US, that was enough to buy a family house in Sydney. And you were sent in there with the money to kind of try and stay reporting until the money ran out or until something bad happened or whatever it might be. So that world has kind of largely gone.
So what are the things that are doing this? Is it the decline of newspapers? Is it the way in which we watch TV? Is it the way we get our media through social media? I had AC Grayling in here the other day, and he was talking about the manipulation of people through data mining and tight targeting of groups and particular messages and the like. Are these the things that are changing journalism, or is there a different spirit within all of us that is not requiring that kind of rigor?
Yeah, everything. I think there's still a desire for rigorous information, but there's no doubt about it that there's been this kind of this smashing of the mirror, in a sense, so that there's a whole bunch of glinting points of light, whereas previously the world was reflected. They called it the media because it was the thing that mediated between power or an event and the mass audience. Now, and so that gave you a very privileged position. You're the gatekeeper, and there was well-funded enterprises that acted in that role as a gatekeeper. And And much of my book really is about those times and the crumbling of those times. So I think there's still curiosity and interest, but it's splintering into lots of different groups, and lots of people feel more empowered to view the world through their own preconceptions. Mm. We all are guilty of our preconceptions. So there's that going on. But the critical thing is the breakdown of the financial model. Yeah. And the connection that existed between the revenues of advertising, which were really held by a very narrow field of outfits. They were the media, they were the you know, newspapers, print, radio, and TV. And they owned the advertising. If you wanted to advertise to a market, you had to go to these people. They therefore had the money to invest in journalism. Now the advertisers are marching off to other places. You get your real estate through realestate.com. It doesn't run a newspaper. And nor car sales or any of these other outfits. So the money has disappeared out of journalism. And so against that, there is a slight countervailing force, and that is that the digital age has made it cheaper and more mobile, more possible to get into places, lightly packed, and get information back out again. So that's become easier and cheaper. But the money for the whole enterprise has really disappeared. Mm-hmm. And the sense of boldness, that public interest, public trust element of journalism has been diminished by the fact that there's no cash left in it.
Hugh, thank you very much for coming in and talking about Mindfields.
Great to talk to you, John. Thank you.
Enjoyed talking to you. I think it's a great book for the holidays. So if you're planning to get a book to take on summer holidays, this is a great one.
I've tried to make it fun. That's the thing. It's a lot of war and a lot of misery and stuff in there, but it's also a lot of laughs. And
scaredy cats like me can live vicariously through you. It's fantastic. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, John.
And Hugh's book, Mindfields, is available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.